Kia ora and welcome back to Stranger at Home. My name is Alex.
I'm Gil.
And this is the third episode of our mini-series where we continue to answer the question,
What does it mean to be a Kiwi?
There we go. I was thinking about doing that accent again from the first one.
No, I had to like get in there before you did that. I was like, do not. Answering the question, what does it mean to be a Kiwi?
There we go. That's a nice clean take.
Thank you.
I'm going to leave it all in though. This week, to preempt our next episode where we've got some very special guests coming on, which we'll talk about at the end, although I think we've already mentioned it, we're going to talk a little bit about digital identity, which I think is something that we've kind of touched on in the past because as a podcast, as members of this generation, as students and stuff, a lot of our life exists online, right?
And with Artie.
Absolutely.
Greeny Memes.
Yes. Greeny Memes, who I think has had some recent victories, I think.
Yeah, some real dubs, as the kids say. I'm down with the kids. I'm familiar with their lingo.
Yes.
No, he's doing really well.
There was some hardship, but I think a nice online response, which I think is something that we can talk about, is like online spaces as community building.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, and so that might be something that we can touch on in this episode. We've got a lot of stuff to cover. It's quite a broad topic.
Yeah, it is.
I think it's specific, you know, like I don't think I was very aware of sort of the digital identity of my country, of my growing upness. Whoa. Where I spent my teenage years. And I wasn't very aware of how Singapore existed online, right?
Right.
I've become more aware as I've followed sort of things like that. I don't know, how aware were you of sort of Australia's national identity as it's represented online?
Yeah, pretty aware, particularly not as a kid. So I was not a kid who had a phone. None of that shit. I had an iPod Shuffle when I turned 12.
That's cool.
It was cool.
Favorite song that you had on it?
Oh my gosh, I was really into Adele.
Not a bad answer.
Rolling in the Deep. Just like imagine like a little 12-year-old me just like weeping on my bed, just being like, so yeah.
I had lost in the thrall of Adele.
Yeah. I like, because I just had albums, right? I tended to like listen to an album in conjunction with, well, that was spooky. Like with a book I was reading. Mm. And so I was listening to Adele's 21 the other day because I was like nostalgia trip. And I was thinking so much about Harry Potter, which I hate. And I was like, why am I thinking about Harry Potter? And then I realized that like I listened to them at the same time.
Oh no.
Yeah. So I was like, I had this feeling. I was like, we can't support Adele. And then I was like, no, wait, wrong way. It's But yeah, no, sorry. That was such a tangent.
See, Adele could write
a
book like Harry Potter, but J.K. Rowling could not sing Rolling in the Deep.
There we go. Perfect. But yeah, no, like Australia's digital identity, I think particularly with like TikTok, I don't know if you've seen the Fairbairn, I don't know, the brothers.
No.
They do stupid skits. They're very funny. Things about like Aldi versus Coles.
Yes, I have.
Lachlan.
Such a good one.
So good. And the accents just send me straight back home. It's great.
Yeah.
But I think that sort of like larrikinism, for want of a better word, has been part of Australia's kind of like digital identity. But also you get the fun thing, because Australia is big geographically and also has states, you get that kind of like local identity where it's like Queensland, and Queensland does things differently, and Queensland users bitch and moan about New South Wales, and that's the whole thing. It wasn't really online, but definitely growing up, state of origin, my God, you're pulling a face that says, I don't know what you're talking about.
Is this like where you came from? Like which state?
No.
Oh.
It's one of the games with the egg-shaped balls, but I don't know.
The egg Oh, it's like, well, like a sport game.
Yeah, it was a version of sports ball.
Of sports ball, okay.
I don't know if it was NRL or AFL, or it was football, but not with a round ball.
Oh, so it was AFL, Aussie Rules Football? AR, what?
NRL or AFL. It was either league or... This is going to be really like
this
horrifying. So many people are going to be really upset at us right now.
So many Australians.
I mean, I think Kiwis know the difference between football codes as well.
That's true.
It's just you, Alex.
Yeah, no, I'm completely lost.
It was one of the sports ball things that people get really upset about, but it was just between Queensland and New South Wales.
Mm.
Queensland, maroon. New South Wales, blue. People got real savage. I was born in Sydney, grew up in Queensland.
Mm-hmm.
no one gave a shit until State of Origin, and suddenly everyone was like, we've got a blue in our midst.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
So everyone just kind of turned on each other.
Yeah. Viciously.
Wow.
Viciously. So yeah, that was like, yeah. So those kind of like small identities, kind of, yes, yeah, sub communities, I guess.
Yeah. There was definitely nothing like that in Singapore, especially because Singapore is a city state, you know, it's one city.
Mm.
I guess there was, I feel like what's really interesting is that international and local populations in Singapore are very sheltered from one another.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm sure there is a lot of like sort of district sort of specificity and stuff. You know, if you were from Bukit Panjang, it's very different from being from East Coast or somewhere like, you know, Central and stuff. You know, it's very, very different. But it's all still one city and stuff. Yeah. I feel like we have a similar thing here in this country, though. It's like the difference between the cities. You know, yeah. I feel like each city kind of thinks that the other cities are shit.
Yeah, well, because Auckland is shit. And yeah, nowhere else matters.
And wow. Didn't you want to move to Christchurch at some point?
Yeah.
It was a hypothetical plan.
That was for people, not the, no, I think everywhere in this beautiful country is gorgeous. And I think that a lot of districtism also has elements of classism, which I'm not a fan of, but I did just make a bunch of lazy jokes, so.
Well, no, that's very interesting, though. I think, you know, if we're talking like an intersectional analysis or whatever, there is classism, there is, you know, demographics involved in sort of these things. I mean, if you look at the way that certain areas are represented online, specifically somewhere like South Auckland, which I think has a huge stigma online, if you look at the way that, you know, let's say the trend of what's being reported in about South Auckland online, you know, or especially when it comes to positive news and negative news, you're going to see positive news rarely calls out the fact that someone is from South Auckland. If it's a, like, let's say someone from South Auckland, you know, something good happens in their life, they make an achievement. If they're like a musician or an artist, they have some big award or whatever, it'll say New Zealand artist, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Or from Auckland, but like if it's bad, it's from South Auckland.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that, I think, raises a really interesting point, which is also when you were talking about like digital identities, I was thinking about social media.
Mm.
But media is also a really important part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, on a kind of like lighthearted end of that discussion, I did see someone being like, crack up that like Aotearoa, like their main news outlet, they're like, oh yeah, it's just like stuff, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's stuff, called stuff.
Stuff. But like things about how stuff carries itself and newsroom and the dodgy ones that I was going to say Courier Mail, because that's like my instinctive
the Herald?
Shit newspaper. Herald. Courier Mail is the Queensland dodgy one. So, and it kind of, you know, like they get identities around them, perhaps not so much as places like, you know, The Guardian or The New York Times or like, no, I'm only with, you know, Fox News sort of thing. There are still like stereotypes and communities, I guess, around even the kind of news media that we consume as well.
I feel like there's definitely a reason that like the New Zealand Herald has to limit its comment sections a little bit more than somewhere like the Spinoff does.
Mm.
Obviously, the New Zealand Herald has a wider reach than the Spinoff.
Yeah,
but it does have a skew. It does have a I think bias is an interesting word that's a bit loaded, but I think it has a skew, like a political leaning, you know, center-right, I would say, more than anything. Whereas the Spinoff, I think, is quite clearly center-left-left a little bit more. So there's more, I would say, inflammatory stuff in the Herald.
It is interesting because I think that a lot of digital identities, in whatever kind of digital space that is, are based around, there's a lot of inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
Inflammation, information.
Whoa.
Six times fast. But like just the idea that a lot of these communities are kind of like based around outrage and clicks and stuff, which working, so I don't know if I've talked about this, but I work in marketing at the moment, content marketing, and it is really interesting trying to, because I'm proud to work for a company that does actually have a conscience, quite nice, but trying to find the balance between, you know, talking about stuff that we really care about, that we think is interesting, that we think real human beings will actually like and get value from, while also holding that intention with the fact that, like, on a very technical level, Google's algorithm works in a very specific way. And in order for people to see your content, you have to kind of like play the game to kind of like SEO, search engine optimization, get it like, get it in front of people. And then also like, you know, convince your boss that your work is of value because people are clicking through and then buying your product sort of thing. And I think that there's that sort of business model you can see inherent in some sort of like news media and social media where it's like the way to get attention is either to be like obnoxious or inflammatory or to like, I don't know how to describe it, but like...
I can think of an example if that would help.
I mean, I was just thinking that like the other end of that is also like not hacking, but understanding and taking advantage of the algorithm rather than producing good content, being like, I know what TikTok will make rank sort of thing.
Yeah. So you're saying like that, like these organizations and individuals who work in the sort of sphere, they tend to cater towards things that'll get them, you know, more explosive reactions and stuff.
Yeah. Or just, I mean, just attention. It's like anything for attention, whether that is being inflammatory or there's like a specific word for it, but yeah, or like manipulating the algorithm on a technical level.
There's definitely, I think, insidious sort of uses of the algorithm. You know, you can talk about things like the alt-right pipeline, you know, like the idea that algorithms, once they, by some quirk, once you start clicking on videos, whether they're, you know, masculine gym workout videos, you're going to start getting recommended videos that trend towards people like Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson, and and you're eventually going to...
My gym absolute icon, Jordan Shapiro. Jordan Fuck.
Jordan Shapiro. That's the final boss at the end of the game. It's Jordan Shapiro. Yeah. No. But you trend towards that and then you eventually start, you know, getting recommended.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they've done some really cool research on that in terms of how particularly engaging with like transphobic content acts as a funnel towards other far right extremism.
Yeah.
Which is, I think we've talked previously about how the far right is better at getting that kind of like snowball momentum of different disaffected and discriminatory communities or people who hate specific ways. And I think, yeah, that social media provides a really rich space for that. Because we will discuss it a little with our amazing guests who I'm so excited about. Got a lot to look forward to, team. But the stuff, pretty sure it's stuff, it's going to be embarrassing if it's not, did an investigation into, called Fire and Fury, into...
Yes, it was.
Yeah, into the right, like the far right media behind the parliamentary protests, parliamentary occupation. And what's interesting there for me in terms of, you know, national identity is that it does feel like a distinctly Kiwi thing. Like it definitely had its own Kiwi flavor and things like Voices for Freedom,
Counterspin,
Counterspin. They are Kiwi, or at least they have a Kiwi mask on. But then you kind of like pull it aside and it's propped up by this, it sounds kind of conspiratorial, but you know, it is this particularly American but also British and just kind of global, like international internet.
And Russian, I think,
Russian,
actually. There's a huge amount of you know, I hesitate to say the word like foreign forces, like, but there is we're importing sort of these fascist notions that are following into this and being wrapped up in this identity and tying into sort of the Kiwi DIY, do it yourself, kind of quite individualist, I would say, outlook.
Yeah.
That I think that sort of stuff embraces, you know.
I was just thinking too that like with like the transphobia in particular, like a lot of the people you'll get something like a Stuff article being like, maybe we shouldn't shoot trans people. And a bunch of the comments will be, you know, these really aggressive, like, oh my God, we can't believe that Aotearoa, the last outpost of morality, is being, you know, pulled under by the transgender
agenda.
The gender agenda. But then you'll like follow those accounts and they're all fucking British. Like you look at them and you're like, oh, these are British TERFs, like, or just TEs. I don't know if they're that feminist, but kind of projecting, but it makes it seem like there's pushback from the New Zealand end when it's not. It is foreign. And so you've got this kind of like dissolving of boundaries, which because the internet dissolves a lot of those geographic boundaries, that provides opportunity for some genuine bad faith actors to, yeah, insert themselves in spaces where they may not traditionally have had a voice. Yeah.
Bouncing off of that in a bit of a tangent, but you know, with the erosion and disappearance of boundaries online, you know, do you feel like that enhances like cultural identity, or do you, like it allows people to kind of broadcast to the world, hey, this is who I am, this is whatever, or do you think it like erodes that ability, harms it? I'm thinking a lot about TikTok, and because we live in this country and I use TikTok, and there I'm on the algorithm for the area, you get a lot of Maori content and stuff about people who are sharing like their moko and describing the process and basically culturally enriching people
lots of cultural education.
Absolutely. And I think that's really interesting because it provides a space, you know, you'd like to, we can claim that it's, you know, it's accessible to everyone. It isn't, but it does provide more of a platform than you might be able to get locally. You know, if you can share this really interesting piece of cultural knowledge with other people beyond just your local area, that's maybe a net positive, you know?
Yeah. It is interesting because I would instinctively say that I think the internet has totally rushed globalization and dissolved national identities in favor of this weird kind of interplay between like hyper individualization, but also everyone's part of the same global community, which is also weird because you think, when I say same global community, I kind of instinctively, like the way I imagine it is America, but bigger.
It's America plus, right?
Yeah. Like it's just kind of like America hypersaturation. Which,
I mean, listen to my accent. It's a product of it, you know?
Yeah.
Of the whole America plus thing.
It is. It's really interesting because, I mean, you get those people in the comments who are saying stuff. There was like a Twitter thread where someone was talking about how like a 18-year-old, ordered a drink and then like asked for their money back because they realized that they were too drunk and they shouldn't have it. And the guy was like, oh, like it was a move so ballsy that I was like, oh, of course, and gave them their money back. And so a bunch of people in the comments were like, eight, what were you doing providing an 18-year-old with a drink? Like an underage. And he was like, I live in one of the many, many countries in the world that is not America. But even like I'm saying instinctively a lot because I'm trying to like separate out my first reaction with the kind of like
in more intentional
stepping back and thinking about it. Yeah. I understand that urge because sometimes people will be like talking in the comments of something and I'll be like, oh yeah. And then they'll be like, I'm not from New Zealand. And I'm like, oh yeah. Like you're like,
yeah,
those people exist.
Yeah.
But yeah.
A very strange thing for an Australian to say. People not from New Zealand exist.
Look, all the best people are in this country.
Sorry, listeners from our international audience, you're great too. You're part of the Aotearoa Plus.
I was going to say New Zealand Plus, absolutely.
Yeah.
I do think that it is really interesting that that opportunity for cultural sharing is valuable. Also provides a lot of space for discourse that I don't know that we have the resources to actually meaningfully discuss.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of social media, right? Yeah. Is that it's just an overwhelming pace of discourse and because of things like Twitter, which have a character limitation and stuff, there is a, I would say it really prevents constructive discourse to happen, and it's not very productive, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think social media has an amazing ability for awareness and even for organizing, I think, you know, it connects people and stuff, but it's really difficult to convince someone or to productively argue with someone.
Yeah.
About policy, about whatever, you know, you can own people, you know, you type out a nice burn or whatever.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that we'll talk a little bit about on our episode with our lovely guests.
Doing my wordy attempts to hit every possible point of people.
You can't outwit Gil.
Well, you can is the problem. You can also outspeak me with a real quick savage, like your mom.
Yeah, that's true.
After I've done like a month's work of writing a long comment.
It's just devastating.
It is.
But yeah, I think social media is really interesting. And I think this country on social media as well, you know, if we look at Facebook as an example, I think we'll want to talk about more with our guests because they have a specific what's the word? They have a specific interest in Facebook comment sections. Yeah. And I think we'll get into that with them.
I think they understand it more like as a native habitat sort of thing than...
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm bringing up my phone because I have notes from essays that I've been reading and have been making my brain ping. But yeah, I feel like Twitter, Insta, TikTok, I understand how they work. I don't like how they work.
No, not at all.
I hate myself for knowing how they work so yeah. well. But I do, yeah, understand them. Whereas Facebook, I'm like, that's what my grandma uses.
Yeah, Facebook, that's like, it's a retirement home. That's going
there. Yeah. Definitely, I've been thinking a lot about how, particularly how the left carries itself on social media. Yeah.
We got into this a little bit, I think, on our first episode about sort of that sort of organizing ability and stuff. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, I mean, I was just like thinking about things like cancel culture when you were talking about how quickly the internet moves and social media moves and mm-hmm. how we haven't been able to kind of like meaningfully structure or even like litigate around it because it's just moving too fast and no one's willing to stop and kind of put processes in place. But someone, a guy called Vasso, I don't know his first name, but was talking about how like much of what we call cancel culture is just culture. Culture has boundaries. Every community has boundaries. Those boundaries are always shifting. In the age of the internet, they move faster, and therefore where those boundaries are is less clear and less stable, and it makes it easier for people to cross those lines.
Whoa. That was really... What does that mean to you?
It's interesting because, again, I have the kind of like emotional instinctive response and the kind of like theory brain response, because my emotional instinctive response was like, oh my God, that's what happened to me when I got cancelled on Twitter.
Mm. Great story.
Good story, team. Stick around for that. But it is really interesting. I don't fully agree with it. Not because I think cancel culture actually exists, but because I think that it's a little too generous. I think it's true. Culture is shifting. Internet culture, we haven't had time to think about it and have, you know, like academics, sorry, the academics haven't had a chance to dig into it and like pull it apart and think about what culture means in its context. Or we're trying, but it's moving too fast and things are constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it's a really good point that even though it seems big and messy and faster and more, you know, times 100 everything, it is still a product of human culture and society. And we've, you know, it follows patterns just at a much faster speed, I think.
Mm.
But I also think that it is ignoring some bad faith actors or people who have learned the rules better than other people and weaponized them for whatever purpose. And that's not me taking a pot shot at the right. Again, that is just people on all ends of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
And other spectrums.
But. Every spectrum is, every spectrum has bad actors, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a way to put it. But I think you're right. I think there are people, and I think on the left, I think we see it a lot more because cancel culture comes up in all sorts of political discussions. Mm. And I think it's really interesting because there are people who learn those rules and then use them in ways that are almost beneficial. To be the person who cancels someone, to be the person to put the thread together to say, oh my gosh, so many of my mutuals follow this person, this is what they've done. And then that thread gets so much attention because everyone's like tagging, oh my gosh, you follow this person, blah, blah, blah. That thread gets 1,000 comments, over.
And then Twitter as a technology thinks that that's important and boosts it. And then it's like a self kind of like, it snowballs. And so you get that dopamine rush, right? Incredible P.E. Moskowitz, I think is their name, wrote an incredible article called Fuck Puritanism, which I'm like, as someone who has definitely like Puritan sympathies, I think that people use Puritan in a cultural...
Can you define the word Puritan for me?
Well, that's the thing. It's a Christian denomination. The fellas who fucked off to America because they were getting persecuted. That was rude. They were getting persecuted. In the kind of wake of the Reformation in England, where you had the kind of like formation of the Church of England, kind of cutting ties with the Vatican and Catholic, and kind of like the split, you know, until then you had Christianity and now you have Catholicism and Protestantism. and Church of England, and then people like Tyndale and Luther, who were like, yeah, really pushing for, I mean, increased access to the Bible, basically, and putting it more in people's hands rather than organizations' hands. And so the Puritans were one of those. They were not Church of England, but they were like a reformist church. They were very anti-Catholic, but had a lot of, ideas about sitting quietly, not wearing flashy clothes, being very cautious about stuff like sex and alcohol. And
would you call it like respectability politics, to put a modern spin on it?
Not really. I think that that's an interesting phenomenon separately, but I think that, they were very conservative in a conservative sense, not in like a right-wing sense, but in that they were like, let's kind of like, the outside world, outside of Christianity, has a lot of sin and self. It's very easy to be super selfish and just give in to kind of like all your base desires. This is not, if there are any actual like theological experts, they're probably going to be kind of cross at me, but this is kind of like the TLDR.
I'm enjoying it.
So in the English Civil War, they were Cromwell and his roundheads, who were, I don't know if you've heard that horrible history song, you know, roundheads, cavaliers, the English Civil War. Anyway.
No, but
okay, well,
might look it up.
They cancelled Christmas and they banned like plays, theater, public sports. And so that's the kind of thing that I think when people talk about Puritanism and new Puritanism, they're talking about that real like, what do you call it? Like prudishness and
kind of withheld.
Like, yeah. Yeah. What do you call it?
Recluse? No.
No.
Retracted? I know.
Buttoned up there, like
an English major. In a
repressed.
Film. There we go.
They're talking about like repressed, but also like trying to share your repression and make everyone repressed and sad and cancel fun. And say no sex, and that's what people have in their head when they think about Puritans. Keep that whole rant in there. But so when the article is called "Fuck Puritan," fuck Puritanism, which again, I'm like, please learn some church history. But I know what you mean. And talking about how the online left works. And one of the things they mention is, people have figured out how to absolve themselves of all responsibility for their lives while simultaneously presenting themselves as authorities over other people's lives.
Yeah.
And I think that when you're talking about those Twitter pile-ons and the rush of being a moral authority, is a real, real phenomenon that we've seen and that has no geographical boundaries. That is a purely internet phenomenon. Something that comes out of our own lives, even if we're not online, but that the online sphere has enabled and turned into a cultural phenomenon, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
So you do see this thing, right, where, Moskowitz's argument was that the left has given up on material betterment of society in favor of moral purity.
Yeah.
Which
wow.
I've been thinking about it all week. It's just been like, bouncing around my brain and running into.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that statement.
Mm.
I think what's really interesting is that this mini season that we've done, I feel like we've talked a lot about politics. I think we've been more acutely talking about politics, and I think that's a product of sort of the topics that we've picked.
Yeah,
obviously, but I think it's really interesting that we kind of are having these kind of broad and very specific as well observations about right and left kind of interactions with society and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think you're so right about I think that's a really quite, it rings true, that statement.
Yeah.
In the sense that it feels like there's a large community of leftists or left aligned people online, but the actual transforming that into real world tangible action, it's very minimal, you know, compared to something like, you know, like actually going out and doing some volunteer
like a labor
work.
Movement.
Like a labor movement, yeah. Exactly. Go on, please.
I think that people think about being on the left as being good people or believing in the right things. Mm-hmm. And I think that being on the left used to mean, or can still mean, like actually doing specific shit.
Yeah.
Like actually like better distribution of power among more people, actually about labor rights and class, which yep. you do not hear a lot of people talking about.
No.
Actually about like literal emancipation, not just like getting people to call out things as ableist online. Because I'm like, calling out does not actually, like, saying I called someone out is not a substitute. That's not an action. That's not a, yep. that's a, I mean, you've done something, but it's not
tangible.
Yeah. It is an intangible, but it gives you that little rush of moral authority.
Yeah.
And then you can, and I'm like, that's not what it actually, yeah, left is not a synonym mm-hmm. for good person.
To bring it back to I think a more local sort of framework,
please. Yeah.
I saw a really well. No, it's no worries. I think these are really good at setting the stage. I think I saw this discussion, and I'd like to preface this with I have no authority of this, because this is a guy named Morgan Godfrey. I think he's like, a journalist, right?
He teaches at Auckland.
He does. Yeah. Yes, yes.
He's done guest lectures here.
Really? Mm. That's cool.
Sorry. I know who you're talking about, yeah, basically.
But I saw a really interesting thing where he was talking about sort of Maori activism online and stuff, which is really interesting. And the reason I say that I have no thing, because I'm not Maori. Yeah. I can't do anything but support those spaces. But what I read was a really interesting thing about how class analysis and class struggle has been left out a little bit in modern iterations of online activism.
Yeah.
Compared to some of the struggles that happened in the 20th century and stuff. Yeah. And sort of those movements kind of forefronted a little bit of class analysis and stuff, like an understanding of that sort of stuff. Whereas it has kind of become about those sort of moral points
yeah.
and stuff. And not just, and that's not to say that the sort of things that are being discussed online within this country, within like the spaces of, you know, liberation for a colonized people are not absolutely valid.
Yeah.
It's just that the focus has shifted, and it's kind of going along with that online playbook of how activism works,
mm-hmm.
you know, where a call out post becomes accepted as a worthy form of activism rather than a more tangible thing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that it is important to have different layers, right?
Yep.
Like we can't all be, I think that violent protest is a valid form of protest. I mm-hmm. think that if all protest was violent, then we would have a fucking enormous problem and yeah. everything would be burnt down. And I think that education, online education, is a valid form of, yeah, helping the movement.
Yeah.
But I, again, if that's all that we're doing, and I think that that's the thing that people have convinced themselves that they are doing all that needs to be done, which sort of leads into one little fun fact about Gilbert's life recently, and now Gilbert is referring to himself in third person.
Gilbert has transcended the bonds of of human existence.
Yeah. Which is, oh, yeah, sorry. zoned out there for a minute. I'm not on Twitter at the moment.
Why is that?
Yeah, well,
because I don't know this. This is a surprise news to me. I
kind of spilt it to you as a little tidbit just before we started recording.
Yeah.
Refused to explain why. Honestly, like on a really personal level, it was shit for my mental health.
Fucking valid.
And I know that that's like, I like roll my eyes so much when people are like, have you considered not being on social media? Social media is bad for your mental health. I'm like, fuck off, I'm having fun. And then I realized I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was stuck in these doom scrolls. Some of my like personal worst tendencies around like obsessiveness and distraction were just being fed by it. And I was just thinking, you know, like this is not an accident or a personal failing. There is a billionaire somewhere who has realized that you can trap people in these dopamine rushes. And it's just on that level, the vibes were bad. I have some really cool communities on Twitter specifically. And I never want to, nothing that I say against that platform is directed against the real human beings who I know through it and who are exceptional humans who find this a tool that works for them. But it is a tool, right? Like it is a hammer, and a hammer can be used to build things, and a hammer can be used to hit things. But at the end of the day, it's not a person. Like a person has to wield it. And so I think that's really important to think about in the context of social media.
Yeah.
But also, I was really frustrated at it. I was irritated at the way people were using it. I was irritated at the way that people who are in my political camp were using it. I had heavy air quotes, finger quotes there. And I just felt like what I want to do in terms of like liberation, class struggles, like making a better world for people, I was not doing any of that on Twitter. And I was like, what I want to do now is like build my relationships with real people across all sorts of spaces. Mm-hmm. I want to volunteer more. I want to get more involved with my church, which I strongly believe makes a real positive difference in people's lives. I want to give out bread rolls and actually do something. And that to be the basis of my political activism and like, yeah, personal politics based around knowing people deeply as people and being able to have conversations that transcend 240 characters and build relationships based on the fact that like, I can give you a fist bump sort of thing. Even if I'm mad at you, I can still, like, we exist in space together.
That's not called a fist bump. That's just called punching someone in the face if you're mad at them.
Punching you in the fist.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really healthy way to look at it. And I don't mean like, oh, take a mental health break from social media. If you're talking about, you know, taking sort of the things that you might learn online and then making them real.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good thing that you've probably done there. And I think I relate to that really strongly. I think that when I reflect back on my time in university, that's an old man noise.
Back in first year, 300 years ago.
No, but I think I came to university I definitely came in a very arrogant sort of mindset. I was one of the more politically engaged people at my school. For a school of 40 in my year, that wasn't very hard.
Slay.
But I signed up as a public policy and media student, right?
Mm-hmm.
I graduated I am a film. Completed my studies as a film and media student. So there was a big shift there.
Yeah.
And I kind of came. I've grown. Well, I kind of thought that I was going to change the world by getting into like public policy and then eventually become like a politician or something. And then I came here and I learned quickly a lot about what was going on here and sort of the struggles and stuff. And I kind of pulled my head out of my ass and went, wow, okay, do we really need another MP who's me?
Yeah.
No.
And I mean, I think you would be a good politician, but I also think...
That's an insult or...
No. Yeah.
No, thank
Genuinely,
you.
Genuinely, I think you're too thoughtful and nice to be a politician.
I think you're right.
I think that you can do some brilliant work in whatever field you go into.
Well, not to be super reflexive here,
yeah,
in the sense of talking about podcast production on the podcast, but I think podcasting in this sort of space can do a lot of good. And in the sense of like community building and educating and this sort of stuff and having these sort of conversations that we have with our guests, because you know, we're not really shy about our political inflections.
Yeah,
and our
raging socialism.
Exactly. And sort of the conversations that we have are foregrounded by sort of that sort of, or not foregrounded, but they're built on the foundation of those sort of understandings and stuff. And we talk about all sorts of things from digital identity, from community building, from, you know, academia, you know, all these
Forest
sort of...
Forest and Bird.
Forest and Bird. Literally everything that we've talked about has a space in the sort of thing that we do. And I think part of, to tie this back to what you're saying about Twitter, I think part of what I regret about being at university is that I haven't been more engaged in my community. I've done a lot of stuff with my degree that I'm really proud of and a lot of really hard work. But then when it came to things like the elections and stuff, I thought I was going to be way more engaged than I was. And instead, I'm pretty proud of despite the fact that I was working a huge amount of hours and finishing my degree and stuff, I still managed to do some good work when it came to the local body elections. I got lots of people to enroll to vote and kind of talk to them about the candidates. I couldn't go out to any door knocking or anything, but I got loads of people to vote, which I'm really happy for.
No, that's awesome.
But I didn't go out and do this other sort of like actual community work. You know, I didn't help out in any way. And I think that's something I want to change, especially about next year. So I'm going to follow in your example, I think. Whether or not I'll delete Twitter.
Yeah. Okay. Now I will say I have taken Twitter off my home screen. I have not deleted Twitter. I have not even logged out of Twitter.
Well, that's still a huge step.
It means I can't automatically click it. And that's something like personally, I'm trying to like work on being intentional about things. And I think that intentionality on a personal level is going to help me grow and be healthier. but also like on a social kind of cultural societal level, I think that it's useful to be like, where am I putting my time and resources instead of letting my thumb kind of make that decision for me? I'm like, oh, I genuinely have more time now, which is actually like slightly nauseating to think about. Like
all the time that's gone.
I got rid of Twitter and now I have tangibly more time in my day. That's upsetting and feel terrible about that.
I've done a similar thing that I put limits on my social media apps on my phone now so that I can't go over a certain time. And the limits on Samsung are really good. You can't just hit ignore and then they just go away. They're like, you can add 10 more minutes and then it's done. Which is nice.
Yeah.
Because if you're like in the middle of an interesting video or something. But I think I have deleted Twitter off my phone. Mm. I have it only on my laptop now and my iPad.
Yeah. I get like the email highlights and it shows me like the 5 people who I love most.
Oh, that's nice.
And I'm like, oh, I can still see what you're doing. And I can like Google's like TEU tweets and I can be like Slay Robbie and like some of my friends' art stuff. And then I can get off.
Yeah, no, definitely a good thing about Twitter is that it does that thing where it can still connect you to the people who you care about and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's great that you're still being able to access that while also giving yourself all this extra energy and time and stuff.
Yeah. I do think, if we have time to discuss this.
We do.
An interesting aspect of, and I think we've talked about it without naming it, is like, we've talked about digital identities in the sort of way of like our identities online. But I think that kind of these discussions about, you know, like how we use social media and how we don't use social media sort of stuff. There's a kind of like inverse of that, which is like how we as people interact with social media, like not just who we are online, but like the people, like how we use it as a tool, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to find a better way to articulate that because they are two separate things, I think. You know, like there's the digital identity, like
how we represent
the hermit.
Yeah.
And then there's the digital identity, like what is Gil Ostini's relationship with
social media? Gil get out of this?
Yeah. And then more broadly, we can kind of look at like, okay, like here is how Aotearoa New Zealand like exists online. As a space, this is like representations of it online.
Mm-hmm.
But then like also like how do people in this country, like what are our social media patterns?
Is it almost like the inputs and the outputs a bit or the outcomes? Like,
or like encoding and decoding if you've done any of that studies?
Yeah. The idea of like how something is built with meaning. Like on one side, the producer encodes a text with meaning and then the audience decodes it with their meaning, right? And how those two are not necessarily the same.
Yeah.
Great theory. Who's that? Is that, it's not Roland Barthes. Who is it? I don't remember.
Can't tell you. My mother brought me up with this shit because both of my parents are academics. And
no wonder you like academia so much.
I spent my whole life being like, I am never going to fucking go into this disgusting, like, I love my parents. I think the work they do is amazing.
Mm.
They were very tired and stressed all the time. I think academia in particular, like, ate my mom up and spat her out when it was done with her. And I'm like, yuck, don't want to do that. So don't ever say that to me, Alex. Don't blame them. This is all on me.
Yeah, that's true. So I think I understand what you mean, like the sort of the way, what sort of meanings and stuff, how are people using it or what is it being used for, maybe that sort of thing. So what do you think about that then?
I think it's really interesting to think about it in terms of demographic use. So I think that like the way that young people in Aotearoa, particularly in, you know, like Wellington, Auckland, or like the big cities, again, big in quotation marks because this country is so small, necessary dig, but I think that the way that like we, like young people in major population centers, use social media is going to be a lot more similar to the way that people in other major population centers around the world use social media than it is to the way that like millennials, even, I know they're young people too, but like I think that there's a difference in the way that we use it. Millennials use it in the way that like older people use it, in the way that our parents and grandparents use it. I think we have more in common with our kind of like demographic globally than we do with people in our own country, if that makes sense.
I think that probably goes to a certain limit. I'd say that maybe millennial. Yeah. I don't think that's probably true for Gen Xers, right? Is that the one before millennials?
Oh, I don't know. I always forget about them.
I would say that they probably have more in common than people locally than internationally. I think it depends what your relationship to the internet was growing up. Because you're being exposed to the sort of internet culture, which is, you know, America Plus. It is an amalgamation of, you know, sort of media texts from all over the world that have become ingrained into the public consciousness. And these are set of essentially references that we all understand, you know, like how we probably all know, you know, a certain set of kids shows or whatever that we all probably grew up on because of how international this stuff is now.
Yeah.
So you could probably bond with someone from America, from the UK, from Germany, from, you know, Singapore, anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you could, because you've probably seen SpongeBob or something like that, you know, for an example, or maybe something more recent, like Adventure Time. You know? And it's the same thing for millennials who grew up in sort of a slightly earlier thing, but then were kind of the first adopters, I'd say, of the internet into their like lives. And then they have all the early references from early YouTube, you know, that we still also share.
Yeah. And it's like the fact that, like, I think there's a kind of boundary in terms of age, like age group, where you kind of see that the internet stops being part of people's life.
Yeah.
Like, not that older people don't use the internet, but it's not part of their life. You haven't got that set of intense references, that culture. They don't, it's a separate culture that, and I mean, obviously there are like outliers, but yeah. And so it is interesting, I think, that there would be like you could kind of split it into people who have more in common, and it's kind of like global and age and reference sense, even though I'm like living in the same city as an older person who doesn't.
I think what's really interesting is the way that it supplants community. You know what I mean? And I think this ties into what you were saying about your experience leaving Twitter and stuff.
Mm.
I think it tricks people into thinking that you're connected and you're plugged into a community, which for some people you are, you know, especially I think for queer youth. I think the internet is
saving.
It's absolutely, because the idea that there are other people you can talk to about your experiences, which are, you know, both unique and also, you know,
shared
and kind of bonding and helping each other through that, I think is huge. But I think in terms of sort of like political struggles, class struggle, whatever, there's an idea that you can be plugged in and connected without feeling that in kind of the real world.
Yeah. And so I think like that access to resources, super valuable, particularly in marginalized communities, right? Mm. Where I can be like, hey, I had this bad experience with my doctor. Does anyone know like another queer friendly doctor in Wellington, sort of thing? That is,
yeah,
like that has an incredible amount of tangible value.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, obviously the kind of like, I'm not alone sort of thing, very valuable. But yeah, I think that people haven't quite realized or come to terms with the fact that it's a tool that's helpful in some ways and unhelpful in others.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the whole theme of what we've been talking about. It's like finding a use for it, finding like, you know, the way that this country uses it, I think can be taken forward. You know, it can be constructive and stuff. And right now I would say it isn't, it largely isn't.
Yeah. And it largely isn't on that like personal level, when it's kind of like, yeah, we just don't like, there's some weird cultural phenomena going on that we're not quite equipped to deal with, and a bit more like intentionality about how we use it could quite probably lead to some really useful outcomes.
Stranger at Home is a Salient Podcasts production, hosted by Alex Marinkovich-Josi and Gilbert Ostini. It was mastered and edited by Alex and managed by Gil. A big thank you to Ronya Ibrahim for our artwork and to Grace Ashworth Lawson for our musical themes. Support your artist friends. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a rating on your favorite podcasting app and share it with a friend. Follow us on Instagram at MIKiwi and at Salient Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Kakite.